Welcome to Information Underground, the world's first speaks cast. Our website, www.info-underground.net. To contact us, send email to theusualsuspects@info-underground.net.
Hello, I am Deep Geek, and this is the first episode of the pilot season of Info Underground. To the best of our knowledge, the first and only speaks cast. I am joined by Mr. Klaatu.
Hello, everyone.
And I'm joined by Mr. Lawson Bronx.
Hello, everyone.
So, guys, I know that the people out there are saying, why do we need another cast? So, let me start by throwing out one reason, and that is that technology changes, and we always need to see if things are ready to adopt change. And so I really want to see if a audio cast sent out as a speech-only codec will work. So we're going to do a series of speaks casts.
Well, no, I think the speaks-only thing is actually not that big of a deal. I think the bigger deal is our idea of the whole gopher involvement, which is, what exactly is our idea about that?
I know, you're fond of the gopher idea, Lawson Bronx. Why don't you answer that one?
Well, it's twofold, and I'm not going to soft-pedal the idea that there's a certain retro-geek quality to it that I think is attractive, at least to me. Plus, I don't know why, but it seems simpler. It took me forever, or it seemed to wrap my head around the idea of just setting up a gopher space. But actually, you know, all told, it took me only about 2 weeks, which is very, very good time for me. So that probably says that it isn't quite as complex as setting up, you know, your own virtual server and then, you know, trying to do HTTP and having, I mean, it's so much simpler to deal with gopher. I think that anybody who has an interest in reading anything we have to write about this show, and certainly the recorded episodes themselves, will find going through a gopher space, assuming they have the right software to do it, simplicity itself. You literally can't find an easier way to traverse through someone else's files than gopher. At least I haven't seen one. And I think it's going to be fun, and I think it'll be, you know, easy to access, or easier than people realize. I mean, they say that there's a plugin for Firefox that works really well with Gopher, but just regular Firefox can access a Gopher page. I've been able to do it with IceWeasel, and I've been able to do it with Firefox, and for something that isn't especially complex, I think just, anything but Internet Explorer will probably do well.
Yeah, don't forget Lynx. That accesses Gopher, obviously, quite well.
Well, that's what I use all the time, but I'm assuming most of our listeners probably won't be using it, at least initially, but once they hear how much...
I don't think I'd make that assumption, yeah.
Well, actually, yeah, you're probably listeners. Right. You're probably right.
You know, you never know, but I mean, what I noticed is that there's a lot of work involved in the whole podcast thing, and I take pride in trying to make my show, Talk Geek to Me, very high in the quality scale. I put out in 6 different audio formats.
Overkill.
Yeah, well, you know what? Somebody wanting archive quality doesn't think the FLAC is overkill, and somebody wanting a fast download doesn't think the Speaks is overkill.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's say I have 700 people scanning my RSS feed, and I get 300 regular downloads, and it'll jump to 700 if I actually hit a topic people want to hear in mass. Maybe I'll get 50 views at the show notes. So for me, with the gopher thing, there's a trade-off in the effort involved to get into fully compliant HTML, just for the few people who do chase it down to that extent. So for me and gopher, dropping text file into a gopher server for the people who need it is going to free me of drudge work.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. It doesn't take a second thought. It's brainless.
Yeah, literally it is just a text file put in a directory, and that's it. You walk away and anyone can access it.
Now, hopefully, you know, we have we're recording ahead of schedule to test things out and stuff. So it'll be quite some time from this recording to publishing, but we actually have a couple of promises of PyGopherD server slices that are not yet materializing, which would mean that a regular web browser would be able to get onto it, except for Opera, oddly enough, because Opera won't switch ports like that. But the other thing about backing up from Gopher and going back to some of the quality issues is we're all recording separately at our individual places, and we're hoping that that's going to show through and shine through in the finished product. So it's going to be a little more editing for the sound, but we're hoping it makes a difference.
Yeah, well, I don't really have a great setup, so I don't know if my microphone's going to be all that crystal clear ever, but in terms of at least being able to set all the voices so that they're more or less equal, that this should really help.
Yeah, you know, getting three tracks when you have that one recording from a conference call involves highlighting each person and doing a cut and paste to put them into the right track.
Yeah, yeah.
And this should be better. This should be much better.
I'm technologically challenged on many levels here. First off, my skills aren't the highest, certainly, but I also don't have a decent recording setup right now. So I'm actually talking into my portable media player and hoping for the best. So who knows? My quality on this end of the show might increase in the days and weeks to come, but for now, this is as good as it gets.
Yeah, but we won't be doing any cell phone recording.
Which is nice. Yeah.
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 Yeah, exactly.
Big plus. Last thing I want to talk about the new show format is licensing. We always have to talk about licensing in 2010.
Ugh, boo, hiss.
So we're going to be releasing this Creative Commons by attribute and share alike, which means that yes, you can chop us up, and yes, you can use us for free, even for commercial purposes. So shovelware engineers, start your engines. But
except whenever if I say the word penguin, you have to cut out the word penguin. that is that. If you're going to use it in a commercial sense, that one I reserve the rights to. So to make it a little bit more complex, as a good license should be, that's my caveat.
Class 2 has had extensive conversations with the Software Freedom Law Show people, and he has a license set up just for himself. It's really quite complex. Yeah. It runs upwards of 80 or 60, 90 pages. It's really, really, really quite impressive.
Yeah.
You guys are such cheeses.
Aren't we?
But let's just hope that if someone makes $1 billion off of the box edition, that they at least treat us like Red Hat treated Linus Torvalds and give us a little cut in the stock deal.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, that would be sweet.
Yeah, I just wouldn't hold my breath there, Deep Geek, about that. But
no, it ain't going to happen. But yeah, I was recently listening.
It isn't about getting anything back. It's not even about giving something away and adding to the community. I think, at least for me, speaking only for myself, it's about an ideal. I mean, I said it in an email to you guys, but it bears repeating. Either it matters or it doesn't, and I think it does, so, this is what we ought to do, or at least that's what I feel, I think that Creative Commons is the way forward for the future when it comes to creative works. Not everyone thinks that way, but I do, and I think that, anything that we're doing should reflect that. So, anyway, on with the show.
So, you guys think we're going to have any speculation on who might join us as future hosts and future guests?
No, not at this time. I'm not even sure, there will be a future. We should, I think we should just, move forward and do what we can with what we've got and see if anybody has any interest.
Yeah, it'll be cool. I mean, if we continue the series beyond, the first three shows that we've kind of got pre-planned as it is, to get some other people on here, just randomly, I guess. Which I guess brings us to the format of the actual show, right? I mean, we haven't really discussed that at all, as I understand it.
You want to give an outline of it, Deep Geek?
Well, no, we're progressing nicely. I want to talk about why we need the new show, and I also want to have, some personal, chance for personal talks about what's going on in our lives. But yeah, I'm in the hot seat tonight, so we're going to just take turns with who's actually hosting the show. So it's like I'm like the host for the show. And the topic for tonight is fringe religion, or, some people might call this religions disguised as jokes, or jokes disguised as religions.
Okay.
I'm thinking about things like the Church of the Subgenius in Texas, Discordianism, But of course, there are the serious overtones that are involved with this, such as mass ordinations, wandering bishop concepts, stuff like that. But I'm really excited to be doing this as a conversation between friends, because if I were to just sit down and write an essay and then read into a microphone and put it out there, you know, it would just be so myopic. You know, but in this way I can, like, actually put the topic out there and see where, you know, guys who probably have more normal views toward religion than myself would like to explore this.
I wouldn't count on that.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, first of all, you know, now we're all net buddies, which means we've never face to face. So, are you gentlemen of the faithful?
Isn't that like a topic for a whole other show? I mean, define faith and define religion and all that other good stuff. So,
well, do you count yourself as an atheist or as a person who has some kind of faith?
Definitely not as an atheist. No.
Okay, and would you say you're not an atheist there, Lost in Bronx?
No, I am a hardcore atheist.
You are a hardcore atheist.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean,
it's
a big topic.
Sounds like we planned this.
Like, we didn't really plan it.
He's an atheist. He's not. What are they going to think about the fringe religions?
But you know, just for the record, I happen to be not an atheist, but I also happen to have been ordained by a Utrecht succession wandering bishop, and I'm a practicing Discordian. You know, so, I mean, where would you guys like to start this?
Well, I would like you to define fringe religion.
Well, I would define fringe religion as religion by the people who don't want to necessarily accept authority of traditional religious figures. So basically, if you get rid of the Eastern Orthodox branches, get rid of the Protestant branches, get rid of the Catholic branches, get rid of the Buddhist and Taoist branches, and get rid of the Islamic branches of religion, what's left, I would call that fringe.
Most of the links that you put in, I went through every one of those links that you put up, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And most of those listed really do come across as elaborate joke. Or at least they seem like they started that way. And maybe, you know, some people have gotten involved and it has evolved over time into maybe something different than the originators intended. But most of it doesn't fall into what I would consider a faith. That is something maybe internal, you know, this is, you know, just a thumbnail definition that isn't meant to pigeonhole anybody or paint anybody in a certain light. But most of the ones that you put up there they really do seem like they were poking fun at religion as opposed to trying to offer some sort of spiritual or physical, in the physical world, guidance for people in their daily lives. And as a result, I wonder if fringe religion, you know, if people who are, you know, I've met a ton of people who identify themselves as Christians who never go to church. Never. They don't belong to any particular branch of Christianity, but they consider themselves very strong Christians. And does that mean that they're fringe? You know, because they're certainly not belonging to a community. I don't know. I'm not sure how to define it, but they certainly take their religion very seriously. It's no joke to them.
Yeah, I mean, those kinds of religion, that brand of religion is more of, I think, it's just inherited tradition. And when people say, oh, I'm this religion, simply because that's what they were told they were when they were growing up. Whereas, at least the fringe religions, I mean, in a sense, I think they might be religious because it's just people ascribing to some belief that they have decided fits their sort of model of the world. Whether or not it's quote unquote religious or not, it could mean that they're making fun of the world because they don't want to take the world seriously, but they do so religiously.
Now, you guys bring up some interesting points that I'm keying on here. Now one is your idea of people who just pick it up as something they were handed to by their parents or something. And I actually met a guy, and he said, the topic came up somehow, and he literally looked at the crucifix around his neck and said, oh, I'm a Roman Catholic, and put it back. You know.
It's like, I'm Roman Catholic.
Yeah, that's it, I'm Roman Catholic. And that was his attitude about it. The other thing was what you were saying, Lost in Bronx, about people who, you know, don't join any church, but are very, very serious about it. Whereas some of the things I define as fringe religion, well, especially like Church of the Subgenius, that is very in joke. You know, to the extreme.
Except that someone's making a lot of money off of it. I mean, I don't know how funny that is. The guy who runs that.
Well, in keeping with religion, though, isn't it? I mean, that is all a part of religion.
Organized religion.
Well, that's, I think we need to keep a very strong, you know, eye on the fact that there is religion and there is faith.
Yes,
And religion is politics. Religion is people. Religion is dealing with other people. Faith is internal. At least that's how I define it.
Well, that's how you're how you're defining religion, but I think I agree with what you're saying. I don't know that everyone does, because some people, at least the idealistic people, would say that religion is also, when it's not a money-making venture, it is a group of people who get together who want to either share ideas because they have a common belief system. And they also want to help other people, like, you know, set up, I don't know, soup kitchens or shelters or whatever, you know. I mean, there is a certain aspect of it of, hey, let's get together and do something that we perceive as being good.
Well, certainly. Without question, there is a great deal of good being done, or at least being attempted in, you know, in the name of religion or in association with religion. But the key to what you just said was people. You know, when you bring people into, you know, other people into a situation, you're getting the whole package. You're getting the good and the bad, and you're getting the, you know, the high, you know, the high ideals, and you're getting the base, everyday, nitty-gritty dollars and cents. And, you know, some people have more ideals than they have dollars and cents, you know, or desire for dollars and cents. And some people are the opposite. Yeah. And sometimes the people who are, you know, the best at organizing people are also the most avaricious. You get what you get when you're dealing with other people. And that's why I think religion and faith are, in a way, they're mutually exclusive. You know, you join a religion or start a religion in the hope, I mean, if assuming we're talking about high ideal, you join a religion in the hopes of finding people who believe what you believe,
yes,
who will, you know, see the world in the way that you do and maybe do good works, you know, the way that you do if you're focused out, you know, outward on the world, or, you know, will help you on your own spiritual path. And I think those are all great ideals. Unfortunately, it isn't all that way.
Well, you guys are both leaving out an important aspect that I find vitally important, and that is the idea of the role of mystic experience in religion, because you're both defining it as it's in its worldly aspects. But there are some people who think, who need to get into an experience that's between them and their concept of spirituality.
That's faith. Yeah, that's what I was taking faith as.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I'm defining it anyway. Or at least that would fall under the umbrella of faith.
Yeah.
In my definition.
Yeah, me too.
You see, to put things under a Christian framework, because the three of us happen to be living in the continental United States, so that's the framework we have to go on, is you can look at some of the major branches as religion via authority, religion via literature, and then there's another branch about religion via mystical experience that is often left out of the equation, and that would correspond to Roman Catholicism, Protestantism, and Gnosticism, or Gnostic Christianity. Oh, there is, of course, I skipped one, tradition, which would be Orthodox, Greek, as in Eastern Orthodox. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, that would be like a major bunch of divisions.
Yeah, tradition should be in, you know, it should have at least as high high a level of importance as the others, certainly, because it definitely provides a social framework. But if we're going to that, I would put that in the religion, you know, umbrella, that is dealing with people and other people. In this case, dealing with people from your past and maybe hopefully the people of your future that you haven't met yet. When it comes to mysticism, I have to tell you, I know about it intellectually. It's nothing I've ever experienced myself. And I cannot speak on that topic in that regard. What I can say, though, is I have met very, very few people in my life who claim to have had a mystical religious experience. I believe that the importance of mysticism within religion has been overblown when you compare it to the number of people who've actually experienced it. Most people, I don't feel, experience a mystical experience on a daily basis, or even maybe even once in a lifetime.
Yeah. Well, actually, because it also depends on where you put things in scale. I mean, you can't argue with a person who says that I feel God exists.
Of course not.
You know,
it's impossible.
There is no arguing with that. If he has the sensation that it is real, you can't dispute it. But,
of course not.
But it sounds to me like Lost in Bronx. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Now, I've had a past life experience.
Okay.
All right. At one point in my life, I was very downtrodden, and I actually entered into like a series of prayers where I said, I'm not going to stop praying until I get an answer to why all this crap is happening
nice.
To me. And praying for like an hour and a half, I was blasted into a past life experience, and it was really far out. I mean, not just remembering something, but actually being someplace else. I mean, the environment looked like where I had been transported to. I could smell. And it's kind of, you know, most people say, oh, I've had a past life experience. I was a elephant tamer in Tibet. You know, that's like the Shirley Winters kind of. No, I was torturing people on behalf of the Inquisition. And I could smell burning flesh. And then I was whacked back, you know, from this dungeon back into where I was. And it was just like, oh, wow, karma, you know.
So you would. I mean, obviously, you would define that as a mystical experience.
Yeah, for me, that was the wildest mystical experience I've had. I've had some other things. You know, and I entered onto a path where I became heavily influenced by Tim Leary's writings on starting your own religion, which involved psychedelics. So, you know, it was weird. You get on this path where you force a mystical experience via drugs, and then for some people, that ends up in having a more, not more real, but a mystical experience not caused or not induced by drugs, which, you know, rules out for the person involved the idea of hallucination. You know, it's something else than hallucination because I'm not taking the hallucinogen.
Well, I don't know. Well, I'm not. Yeah, I wouldn't go that far myself, because people have been known to hallucinate without having hallucinogens. People have been known to have, you know, fantasies, real, you know, fantasies in real life thing. I mean, the mind is a very complex thing, and people sometimes see what they want to see, even if they're not conscious.
Well, and there you go, though. That's.
I'm not going. No, now let me just say this first. I don't poo-poo your experiences, and I'm not saying they didn't happen. I can't, as you pointed out. It is impossible for me to disprove anything you say, and I have absolutely no interest in doing it. What everyone, see, I'm of the opinion, strongly of the opinion, that religion, however it is defined for a person, faith, however it is defined for a person, is a deeply, deeply personal thing. It is the most personal thing on earth, okay? Or in the human experience. And you can choose to share that or not. That's fine. But there is no way that anyone else can define it for you. They try. They have tried over the centuries, over the eons, people have tried. But in the end, it all comes down to you and whatever else you see in the universe. And so what you have gone through is what you have gone through. And I can't say anything to that. But I can speak on, you know, on my opinion on things. And in my opinion, you know, the human mind can play tricks on itself.
But isn't that just, I mean, isn't the human, why can't the human mind be, why is it not a mystical experience if the mind is involved, you know? I mean, I think that's actually one of the greatest sources of mysticism is the activity of your brain during meditation and things like that. You know, it's that connection between you and spiritual world that causes a mystical experience.
Define a spiritual world, though. I mean, in a way, we're getting kind of off topic because we're going into the nature of faith.
That's true. Yeah.
The, you know, fringe religions in America. But you know, a spiritual experience is what you define it as. You know, I mean, Deep Geek just explained what happened to him. Okay. I could explain it away in 100 different ways, in 1,000
Sure.
different ways, if I had different areas of
Yeah.
expertise, you know? Or I could accept it at on face value and say, yes, I believe this could happen. What I'm saying is, yes, I believe you believe it happened.
Well, as long as we don't get into the position of the Roman Catholic Church and St. Paul, I can live with these things. Because if you read the Pauline, the Acts of the Apostles, St. Paul has the encounter with Jesus on the road to Damascus, and the description is very succinct and explicit. He describes flashing light first, then the vision of the Lord. And a modern 21st century doctor would look at that and go, well, that looks like epilepsy. You know, if you want to write it
And
off.
well, that's true, but then a UFO enthusiast would say, well, he was obviously abducted.
Well, that's another strange thing about if you actually talk to people, you can actually ask people questions about what they would say to an angel, and then ask them questions about what they would say to a being from a UFO, and they would give you the same
Yeah,
answers.
a lot of people associate the two things very strongly.
You know, it's weird.
Yeah, yes.
It really looks like at one point in time, a paradigm changes in the mass consciousness, and all of a sudden we're talking to advanced people from space
Right.
instead of advanced beings from
Yeah.
heaven.
And before that it was fairies, and mystical people under the hill who would sometimes come out and abduct people, and they would have strange experiences and then come back, sometimes bruised, sometimes battered because, of all these strange things that the fairies did to them. I mean, this experience or stated experience has been recorded throughout history. It's just been given, different defined terms as to what these people feel they've experienced.
So,
Yeah.
what are they experiencing? I couldn't begin to tell you. I couldn't begin, I mean, I don't know, but just because I don't know doesn't mean, I have to assume that what they say happened really happened. The fact is, if you're dealing with a divine being, if you decide that you have had an experience with a divine being or a divine power of some sort, absolutely anything is possible, including the fact that I could be sitting next to you having a regular conversation, and then at the end of it, you could say to me, in the middle of that, I was transported to heaven and I spoke to God. And then I came back down and he told me not to act like I'd seen anything. And I can't disprove that. I can't say it didn't happen to you because a divine being, by definition, can do anything. In a way, trying to say that, I mean, I am a hardcore atheist, but I cannot tell you it doesn't exist. There is no way I could tell you that, but I can tell you it doesn't exist for me.
Well, Klaatu, I know you're fond of anarchism. So, I mean, what do you think of religion as a disorganization, or disorganized, or personalized, or de-authorized
I
concepts?
think that ultimately it is that anyway. It's just that a lot of people insist upon giving the authority away to someone else, but they still believe their own variants of whatever religion they say they're a part of. You can go into any denomination, whether it's Catholic or Baptist or Episcopalian or whatever, and you can listen to what the priest or the preacher or whatever figure they've got up there is saying, and then you can speak to people afterwards, and everyone has their own spin on what is acceptable, what's not acceptable, and so on. So, I mean, I think it is not really that organized anyway. It's just that people seek to make it a little bit organized by banding together and giving the authority away, which frankly is sort of how the rest of the world works too. I mean, we're individuals, but we just
Well, I mean,
Yeah,
yeah, isn't that politics? Yeah, I mean.
we give away our rights to make our own choices, along with a lot of other rights, ostensibly for our own benefit.
Many people don't want it any other way.
I think they're afraid to have it a different way. I think they're really, really afraid of what would happen if they had to be responsible for for themselves, for their own beliefs, for their own actions, whatever.
Well, I mean, not to be lurid, but I've known my share of losers, and there are an awful lot of people that really should not have those kinds of decisions left up to them.
that I disagree with Lost in Bronx, of course, that people, that society makes people into losers, either it forces them or whatever. But most people, if they have what they really need in life, they just want to be happy and have a good time.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that.
Well, you know, we really dove into the deep end of the waters first. I mean, I wanted to leave it freeform, see where it went, but I had every intention of starting talking about these college guys back in the 50s who were required by their university to attend so many services per semester and formed the Reformed Druids of North America to make that requirement. And when they did so, they put the university in a position where they either had to pronounce on what is a valid religion or not, or drop the requirement. And the university did indeed drop the requirement, because they didn't want to go there, as they say. But, I mean, you know, the cat was out of the bag at that point, because, I mean, Reformed Druids, you know, going back to worshiping trees, I mean, it added a surrealism and an absurdism to it. Now, Lost in Bronx, talking about the absurd and the surreal, I understand we've both read the same book at one point.
Yeah, the Illuminatus trilogy.
The Illuminatus. Have you heard of this book,
Clancy? I've heard of it, but no, I've not read it. Read them.
Let me give my 30-second blurb, or I'll try to give a 30-second blurb. A couple of Playboy...
Good luck.
Playboy editors... Playboy had this great column called Letters to Playboy. It was nothing like Letters to Penthouse. People would ask for advice, and they'd do some well-researched advice. But they would get their kook letters, and two editors who got fired when they were making too much from Hugh Hefner saved the letters and made all the wacky letters into a real universe. Now, that's my take on it. What's your take on it, Lost in Bronx?
Well, the Illuminatus trilogy is more or less like a sponge for every pop cultural reference, every fringe religion, every strange or bizarre idea. You can plug it into the Illuminatus universe, and it all fits. There isn't anything that doesn't fit. In fact, things that conflict with each other even add to it. So you have the Discordians, you have the Church of the Subgenius, you have the Catholics, you have the FBI, you have John Dillinger died for you.
The Don Dillinger Society.
Yeah, and John Dillinger turns out to be one of the heroes of the book because, of course, he never did die. You know, it's just a sprawling, meandering, unbelievable blather, you know, and you could pick pieces from it. You know, you could just open it at random and read a passage and laugh out loud, because it wouldn't be worth reading if it wasn't funny, and it's very funny. But it also has, you know, as my mother would say, a pound of it doesn't weigh an ounce. There is no intrinsic meaning that I got out of it outside of the fact that it is nonsense. It does poke fun, not just at religion, at least in my opinion, not just at religion, but at everything, at culture, at us. It pokes fun at us and the silly things that we sometimes believe. Even if we don't think they are silly, but other people almost certainly think that almost everything we hold sacred is silly. And this book kind of, and it's a series of three books that were published over, I don't even know, a long period of time. But now I think you pretty much can only find it combined into one omnibus, and they kind of reprint it every few years, I think.
Yeah, so that just won't go out of print.
Yeah, it's really quite a thing, and I read it at a time in my life when it was fun to think about conspiracies. Oh yeah, conspiracies are big on these. I mean, massive conspiracies, right. The Illuminati, obviously, and the Masons, and the FBI, and the CIA, and the Kremlin, because this was back during the Cold War. And all of these things are connected in some esoteric way.
It really is.
That could be a way to describe it. Yeah.
It really is amazing. But anyway, that was one of the two is Robert Anton Wilson. And actually, in the show notes, there's a copy of a speech he gave called "Religion for the Hell of It," where he steps through, where he's addressing an Irish audience because he was an expat in Ireland for a while, and he's stepping through a history of oddball kook religions. You know, and a lot of material that it comes from him is really very apropos to this topic. So, like, the information about the Reformed Druids in North America. The interesting thing is Also, the next thing he talks about is the Universal Life Church, and I know that one of your co-hosts on the old show, Linux Cranks,
ordained with that church, yes.
330. Ordained with that church.
Minister.
Yeah, 330. And Kirby, who started that church, started out with the idea of ordaining every man, woman, and child, because he said they all have equal rights to be a clergy person. You know, which is, it's interesting, because he does it in a very valid way. Because if you look at it traditionally, if you look at the formation of Lutheranism, you have a priest that gets excommunicated and starts a new religion. So he takes it from an already established body, and then he gets kicked out of that, and he starts something new. And the same thing happens when you have what's called the wandering bishops, where, you know, a bishop can make priests. So you have a bishop that gets kicked out of whatever he was in, and then he can make more bishops and make more priests and make his own faith, basically.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I read through the definition. I mean, I spent a whole night going through all that stuff that you put there, and I don't understand. They get kicked out, right? But they're not really out, according to church dogma or church law, because somehow there's some gray area about they still have the right to make priests, to ordain people as priests, even though they themselves are not considered. How did it go? They have their power stripped from them, but they're still considered bishops.
They have their relationship with whatever mother church they hailed from is dissolved, but it has to do with a doctrine in mysticism known as initiation. And initiation is a one directional process. In other words, if you decide that you're going to embark upon the path, you know, you can't ever get off it. And in the same way, if you decide to become a priest and you get yourself ordained, you can't.
Because ultimately,
can't take
that comes
back
from God.
Because
those powers, as it were, are vested in them by God. And the church can speak for God officially, but it does not strip away the powers that God has ordained a priest, as I understand it.
Yes. Yes, you have a regular. I mean, I don't know if I'm explaining it right. Do you get sense out of that, Lost in Bronx?
I do, and I really, you know, I could argue back and forth, but that would be, of course, what people have done for centuries over this exact topic. But as I understand it, that is how it's often defined, but not always. Right?
No, I do believe it's always, but I'm not 100% sure.
I don't think it is always defined, because especially within the Protestant denominations, the church does not speak for God, and so a preacher may, in certain denominations, not have powers given to them by God, and if they are kicked out,
this is interesting.
Privilege taken away from them, and that's the end of that story. They're fired.
Yeah, because when I began getting upon the path of actually being ordained, my bishop asked me what my first religion was, and I told him Methodism, which is a Protestant faith. But Methodism doesn't use ordained people. In other words, they don't have succession that they claim traces back to St. Peter. And therefore, since my bishop was independent Catholic, I was considered even unbaptized. And I had to go through rebaptism
through RCIA and everything.
It was much more informal than that. It was over the dinner table over several nights, actually. But if our listeners want more information about the mystical idea of ordainment and initiation and the one-way nature of it, I can refer them to a book
Holy
that will
Catechism.
Never go out of print. It's called Science of...
That would work.
No, that's for the laity. That's for the laity. No, my textbook was Science of the Sacraments by Charles Leadbeater, and I can highly recommend it. It's an interesting thing, because we were talking about the Universal Life Church and 330's ordination under that. I have an ordination that goes back to what's called the Utrecht Succession, so I have what's actually a Catholic succession. But even, you know, like, I'm very much touched by Discordianism. And whereas Kirby and the Universal Life Church set out to make as many priests as possible, the Discordians decided they were going to do one-upmanship and make as many popes as possible.
Oh, jeez.
Now, you two know where I'm going with this. It is interesting to note that the Roman Catholics say that they can give indulgences over videotape. And so I feel quite comfortable over a Speaks file telling all the listeners to this audio cast, they are now hereby popes in the Discordian faith and now hereby excommunicated. So they all have their own religions of one. Congratulations on your preferment, guys. I hope you enjoy it. I actually tried to make popes out of an atheist podcast. Jury's still out how that email is going to come down. I'll keep you guys abreast.
Well, I wouldn't be the first unbeliever to practice the religion.
So, is there anything else we have to touch upon, guys?
Are you aware that the Church of Subgenius is often cited as the source of the name for my one of my favorite distributions, Slackware?
No, you're kidding. Right.
No, I'm not kidding.
What is this? That's which true. Distribution is this?
Correct. Concept yeah. of Slackware. Slack or being a slacker.
Yeah, getting Slack.
Or getting Slack.
Slackware.
Getting
in fact,
slack.
In that, if you read on my Gopher Space, if you read the Patrick Volkerding Linux Journal interview from 1994, I think it was, they say, where did you get the name Slackware? And he says, my friend Bob Dobbs gave it to me, smiley face with a wink. So, I mean, no one really, I guess, knows, you know, what that's all about, but yeah, that's Slackware.
Well, from my understanding of Subgenius, and I'm not a member, is that there is a space between somethingness and nothingness. So if you look into wherever you are at, look around you, you'll see things interspersed by non-things. And where there is a gap between a thingness and a non-thingness, that's where you get your slack from.
I had not heard that part of it. No, I did not know that. I didn't know they got that granular, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, that's definitely the sort of conversation and the topic that, you know, gets better and better as you pass the bong.
A lot of this has that air of that old college tripping stuff. Oh, man.
Well, I mean, the irony is so deep, yeah. You need a jackhammer to cut through it with, you know, the Church of the Subgenius. I mean, it's odd that we could sit and talk about it in the same context that we would with spirituality or wandering bishops and other things. But the fact is that as time goes on, very often things like this can start to tip in a really serious direction. Sometime after Elvis Presley died, a religious scholar, I don't remember who, but I read an article by this guy who pointed out so many of the fundamental aspects of Elvis mania in modern culture as the very early footprints of a religion. And he drew direct parallels to Christianity and said, you know, in the early days of Christianity, this belief seemed to be prevalent. And the parallels were uncanny. Now, I don't think, you know, in the far future, we're going to see too many people praying, you know, to Elvis necessarily, but he didn't believe so either. But the point was just that religion can find its inspiration in the oddest of places.
That's certainly true. That's certainly true. To talk about the deification of a person who lived, my first acid, no, maybe my third acid experience, I became convinced that Jim Morrison was the reincarnation of Christ, which probably in and of itself is not unique, but what impressed me about having experimented with hallucinogens in the quest for religion and faith is that eventually I had a bad experience with LSD and swore it off as a result. However, and this is the part that really sticks in my brain like a splinter in a piece of wood in your skin, I continued for maybe 5 or 6 years believing that Jim Morrison was the reincarnation of Christ, until one morning I woke up and realized during shaving that I was mistaken. Just like that. That was some wacky stuff.
Interesting.
Well, I hope that didn't offend your sensibilities,
no, no, no,
Mr. Plateau.
No, not at all. Just, I was pondering it. It's interesting.
There's also something when you talk about faith, as a tangent, you can also talk about the confessional literature, and I guess we'll just have to chalk many aspects of the things I've said to you guys in our podcast, I mean, excuse me, SpeaksCast listeners, as my confessional literature. Is so if I've imposed on people or offended people, I apologize, but I wake up and I go out into the world every day, and I am just impressed by the Lord's sense of Schadenfreude. There's a certain malicious, weird, laughing at you humor just in the way the world is built, and that has affected me in very interesting ways over the years.
Very cool.
Cool. I was wondering how far you take the definition of fringe religion, and I don't know if this can be cut in at some point, but I was going to say, how far do you take the definition of fringe religion, because there are certain things that might have almost started, and I guess Lawson Bronx kind of mentioned this, but they almost start as a fringe religion. Like, I'm thinking specifically of one that I believe in very strongly, Christian Science, which is the Mary Baker Eddy principle, you know, that she believed generally mind over matter kind of things. And that, I mean, that was really, I mean, Mark Twain wrote about it and made fun of it because it was just so crazy. But, I mean, today it's considered among most people a very valid one. And then you've got a new fringe branching off of that where you've got these super fundamental Christian scientists who, you know, infamously don't give their children any medicine when they're sick, and then they die, and then they make the news, you know, all that other stuff. So, I mean, what does this qualify? Is this a natural progression of religion? It starts fringe and then becomes fringe, and somewhere in there's a middle line. I mean, what do you think?
A strange effect that religions have. I mean, let's go back to the Druids, the Reformed Druids of North America. Now, this was a bunch of college guys who started a joke religion to mess with their university, right? All right, but then what happens was the university backs down, and you would think that, okay, we can disband now, right? But actually what happens was is that what they started gets built upon, people find it satisfying, and so that goes on to this day. All right. Now, the other thing that's interesting about mind over matter is that Dale Carnegie, a Freemason, wrote a book called The Power of Positive Thinking. I believe it was Dale Carnegie. Power of Positive Thinking. Author of Power of Positive Thinking was hospitalized, realized that people getting out faster had a positive attitude. Okay. So there is, you know, doctors would call it a placebo effect and minimalize it.
Well, I personally, you know, even though I don't subscribe to, you know, the concept of advanced mental powers doing this sort of thing necessarily, there is a direct correlation between depression and, you know, the degeneration of the human body, you know. People that are depressed get sick more often. It is a proven fact. And people that tend to have a sunnier attitude, it is no guarantee, it is no shield against disease or decrepitude, but people who have a sunnier attitude tend not to be as ill. And certainly, maybe they just don't seem to suffer as much when they are. So, I mean, I think that there is a connection there. You know, I do think that there is one. I don't know what it is necessarily. I couldn't tell you, you know, what molecular chains are working in the brain and the body to make it function, but I think it does exist.
There is a interesting matrix involved with this, because it's not just even the positive thinking. There is what happens to you from the real world out there, and then there is what you think of it or how you interpret it. Now, an interesting exercise if you ever have people who are willing to do this with you. If you're sitting down to break bread with people, is to have everybody write down their description of the room they walked through to get to where they're sitting now, and you will see that every piece of paper will be different. You know, now
of course, but a lot of that has to do with what we notice and where our minds are at the moment we pass through.
But then,
that room.
Doesn't it matter that? Some people will notice the bad things that happen to them more than the good things, and some people will notice the good things more than the bad things.
That's true.
So you see, now, one thing that's interesting is people who think, some people call this co-creation. In other words, they believe that the Lord gives us a certain amount of external reality, but the rest is something we create with Him by our interpretation of it. It's an interesting offshoot of interpretive thinking. One group of people actually went so far, and they actually found out that statistically, people who are members of JFK assassination groups, study groups, tend to file more reports of violent abuse than the public at large.
That is bizarre.
Yeah, it is. You know, the mind is such uncharted territory, and you can't say that to a scientist, because scientists say, "Well, you're just thinking that," or what kind? To give me the parameters of the study, whatever. But let me suggest to you an idea, and this should be done a couple of times, is next time you're going to walk through a parking lot, look for a quarter. See if you can find a quarter on the way to wherever you're going.
Oh, I do that all the time.
So you've already started. Great.
Well, I'm a cheap Yankee.
Then
I can't help it.
Try the day after you're going to walk that path again. Instead of saying you're going to look for the quarter, promise yourself the next day you won't look for it. But tell yourself 50 times to yourself in your head that tomorrow you're going to find a quarter. And see if when you're walking this path, you find a quarter. And then try it the other way again, and then repeat the experiment and see what happens. I think you might be interested at the results.
You know, I can tell you right now,
I'm going to do it just in hopes of getting enough money for a cup of coffee on the way to work every day.
That would be hot, huh?
Well, you know, I will look for those quarters. I do it all the time. You know, I mean, there aren't really any payphones anymore, but I used to check those things for loose change. You know,
Try talking yourself into believing you're actually going to find them and see and note the difference.
I can't talk myself into things I don't believe. It just, you know, again, you're in the area of
no, we're in the area of hypnosis now.
Well, yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah, it sounds like it. But, I mean, just because you hypnotize yourself doesn't mean there's going to be a quarter there. But,
you might be surprised.
To me, that is, well, I would be surprised. I'd be exceedingly surprised at the coincidence, because I couldn't do it twice. And I guarantee you wouldn't be able
I've done this experiment three times.
Yourself.
And two of the three times it worked.
What is a working...
Do it 100 times. You know, is that scientific? Come on.
Well, I mean, it's not scientific until we have a preponderance of studies we can compare. And if you don't try it with us, with me and Clat too, how are we going to do that, Lost in Bronx?
Well, you're going to need all the help from all your listeners.
Can we get results from each of those listeners about how many quarters they found?
It's an interesting exercise. I promise you that even you might be interested in seeing your attitude toward the experiment change from before you tell yourself something 50 times to after it. You might just be interested in that kind of self-hypnosis aspect of it.
I might be, but it doesn't sound like I would be. It's really not compelling to me. In any way,
okay.
That's so frank.
I'm sorry to say.
I like that.
I've been known to speak my mind. So I hope you don't mind that.
Certainly
I speak
not.
Mine. We're kind of stretching this out, but I did want to bring up one question, and that is, where do fringe religions turn into cult? Okay? Very often people cite that religions, you know, very big, popular, powerful religions started as what in their time period, people considered a cult. You know, Christianity is a good example. More ancient religions like Judaism, I'm not sure you could, because that actually goes back to almost Stone Age times if you follow it through. Where do religions that just sort of seem to spring up or over the course of you know, maybe only a century or so springs up? What's a cult? What's a fringe religion? You know, I mean, where do, you know, those guys that killed themselves thinking they were going to be on a flying saucer behind the Hale-Bopp comet. You know, before they did that, people just laughed at them because they were weirdos.
Well, see, and, I don't know. As I understand it, after the cult that, people is very centric, typically around a single, almost, perception. They perceive this central figure that is almost like godlike or has special powers to talk exclusively to God. And there's no,
like,
probably not, because I don't know
Bob
that that
perhaps?
Many people actually think that he talks to God or anything like that. So,
well, what's interesting is I did include, I did find one of those 15 question tests on what is a cult. It seemed now before I get into the test and what I think about the test, there seems to be a couple of different ideas. One is, how much does the belief system being tested test against the idea of you being at someone else's control through it? Is one measure of being a cult. But some people who don't want to bring in any of the dogma into the equation might simply ask, well, how much money do they get out of you for this? More or less than 10%, more or less than 20%. Some people have a strictly financial idea.
Okay.
And, you know, similarly, you know, we talk about Master Daemons. I talked about Master Daemons briefly on today's audio cast. Interestingly enough, certain state tax authorities define a genuine religion as having 13 followers per minister, to have a bureaucratic definition. I looked at the test, and I looked at the test and said, well, let's see. I know a few mindsets that I've been through in my day. So I tried to answer the test as an Ayn Rand-style objectivist, a Roman Catholic, a Methodist, and a Discordian. Oddly enough, the Ayn Rand objectivist one came out the highest on the cult test, followed by the Roman Catholic, then the Protestant, and then the Discordian. Like, there was like only one question that got a yes to on that whole test. It was just interesting. So, you know, check the links.
That is surprising.
I get weird out. The one I remember was the guys on the internet trying to recruit people, and then they found out that all the males were eunuchs. That happened in the early 90s, and that, like, freaked me out. I mean, because, like, you know, I'm talking a lot about humor, like the Subgenius and the Discordians. They're fun to think about, or even the Java Crucians, right? About the coffee worshippers, right, Klaatu?
Yeah.
You know, I think it should...
That's become a joke in our house. We do it in the morning.
So, I mean, I'm like, you know, dude, if you're going to join a cult, at least join one that's fun. Yeah. Don't join one where they ask you to cut your parts off. Bell should ring, you know?
Realistically, I mean, you know, we're obviously talking... we're not talking about Jim Jones type of guys, necessarily, right? I mean, although that tends to be the most extreme cases, you know, where, you know, you go off to your magic island or your hidden place in the jungle and you all kill each other over some bizarre order. And it, you know, I mean, we're not really... I mean, that's not really what I'm talking about anyway. I mean, where do you draw the line? I think the modern druids are probably the perfect example. That started as a joke and B, a way of getting around what they considered to be a rule that they didn't like. It was a rebellion act, an act of rebellion. And it was done with jokes. I mean, the whole Irish whiskey thing that they use as their sacrament. I mean, it was all done for laughs. But there are people that begin to take it seriously. And there are people who identify themselves as druids and find some sort of mystic, you know, experience, sometimes anyway, out in these woods. And I think at some point, very often, and it takes, who knows, it takes time, it takes definitely takes people, sometimes a joke can become something else. They can evolve into something completely different than what they started out to be. You know, I mean, if we had time machines and went forward and we found, you know, born again Presbyterians everywhere, you know, we would fall on the floor laughing, and then we might get burned at the stake for doing it, because these people take it seriously. You
know? I think so.
Alrighty, I think we've run our course then.
Thank you for listening. You've been listening to Information Underground. Our website, www.info-underground.net. Our email address, theusualsuspects@info-underground.net. For show notes, see the link that accompanies the file download at our webpage. Information Underground is released under Creative Commons license, attribution, share alike, commercial, use, as well as derivative works are permitted under this license. Our theme music is an excerpt from the song Data Transfer Protocol by Someone off the album Mechanical Monkeys, used under a Creative Commons attribution, share alike, non-ported license. Thank you.